Hello and welcome to episode number 23 of the Beards and Bulldogs podcast. I'm Aiden and this is my dad.
Hi, yes, it's me, I'm Scott. Welcome to episode 23. How's your week?
It was alright.
Yeah.
I had first week back at school.
Yep.
We had to set up laptops because now we're in senior, we have to use laptops a lot more, which was a pain in the ass.
Yeah, on the risky laptop. Has died like three times.
Yeah.
and of course you got your brother there as well.
Yeah.
Which would be causing no levels of frustration.
No, he hasn't. It hasn't really came to me anymore. I walk past him and he's like, hey. I'm like, hi.
Is he actually like with other kids doing things or is he just hanging about?
Yeah, I've seen him with one friend.
Okay.
And apparently he's got a friend group.
Okay.
I haven't seen him. They go somewhere else to break.
Okay. All right. Yeah, cool. Good. Good. Anything else exciting from the week?
Oh, a little good thing with the laptops is we don't have to bring textbooks because the textbooks are on the laptops in the school drive somewhere.
Okay.
So that's less books. And then with some classes, you can take all the notes on your laptop. You don't need an actual physical book.
Okay.
So as long as my laptop doesn't die, it's going to make life a bit easier.
Yeah. Hopefully. Cool. Good. Excellent. Well, that's going to help. Some of the stuff that I've come across this week, and I've got some news. I've managed to find some odd bits of news that I find interesting here this week. For those of you who are adult enough to need to go and get petrol, you will notice that petrol is really expensive at the moment. It's been getting that way for quite some time. It's going to continue to get worse.
Oh.
Yeah, it's not going to get any better anytime soon. Several reasons, barrel prices and stuff like that are quite high at the moment, which is quite odd if you understand the concept of how fuel is and oil is traded. It's sort of traded 3 months ago is what people brought oil that is getting used now. It's really, really odd. Anyway, it's really expensive at the moment. The oil cartel, there is like a cartel, a group of people who control the oil and oil prices and how much is manufactured and sold, because obviously it doesn't come from everywhere, it only comes to certain parts of the world. Those people are withholding oil production, therefore costing oil to go up.
Why are they withholding production?
So that it's worth more.
What the fuck?
So if less goes out, they get more money for it, and they've managed to bring their production to a point where they don't need to keep pushing it out. There isn't a whole stack load of it sitting anywhere, so they can sort of hold it back.
That's disappointing.
Yeah, it is. It is. So that's going to cause continued angst and frustrations, no doubt. If you are thinking of getting fuel, there's a couple of things you can do to try and get cheaper fuel. Number one is understand the ebb and flow of the fuel price in your local area. It will peak and fall throughout times of the week. So try to avoid getting it on the weekend or around Thursday, Friday. Try and get it sort of a bit early in the week. Around Tuesdays or Wednesdays is generally better. On top of that, if you're in Australia here, we have the Fuel Spy app, which you can get. That will tell you where the current fuel prices are, especially here in Queensland, because most of them need to report that through. Not all of them do, but most of them do. And that will help you get fuel cheaper. Some of the smaller independent ones have cheaper fuel. There are different risks that come from going to cheaper ones than going to your more expensive Coles or Coles Express, Shell type places, BPs. Because your Shells and your BPs, they retain much higher levels of fuel. They don't let tanks run down quite so much. So the fuel stays up a fair bit more, and if fuel's in there, other shit can't get in there. So the more fuel you got in there, less other shit. Some of the more independent ones let them run down a little bit further, so you get down close to that shit layer. So there is some risks with some things, but if that servo, if you know that servo you pass all the time and it's getting continual people through, and it's not just sitting there with fucking no one at it, if it's constantly getting continual people through, then it's going to be running that fuel through quicker. Therefore, it's probably a little bit safer to go there. So there's one that we've found near our home here that pretty constantly has cars there. It constantly runs through the fuel. So the chances of the fuel being dirty and filthy are much, much less. If you're going to go to a cheap servo and there's no one there, and there's been no one there for a week, I'd be a bit suspect of the fuel. mainly because fuel and water don't mix, so you'll end up with some fuel, some water. You don't want water in fuel.
Yeah.
So there's some tips there for even younger people. As you get older, fuel prices will still be a problem. Need to be things to be aware of. Understanding what to keep a lookout for will help you not pay what I think in some parts of Brisbane at the moment, 98 fuel. So the unleaded 98 is over $2 a litre.
Jeez.
All right. So if you were going to say we had our XR8 still, Falcon XR8, the ran on 98 fuel, if we still had that, you know, you're looking at $2 a litre, fuel tank would take from probably its lowest point about 60 litres thereabout. So, you know, it's $120 to fill the car.
Jesus.
Yeah. So diesel is a little bit cheaper. Diesel doesn't use oil, but diesel's still expensive because fuel companies are assholes and they think that no one knows anything and they think that diesel comes from the same place as unleaded and therefore they try and charge similar amounts. It doesn't. Production is suffering and that's why its prices are a little higher, but they probably shouldn't be as high as what they are.
But, yeah.
Yeah, whatever. Diesel burns differently to fuel and that's a whole different argument. Next up to some really weird news. So in the US, two police officers, and I don't know which county or regional state or whatever the hell it is, two police officers have recently been fired for playing Pokemon Go while at work.
What the fuck?
Yeah. So apparently they got called up. There was a robbery in progress that got called up by their boss, dude, and they decided to not go. They were like around the corner and it was spotted like, you know, driving up the alleyway and the in-vehicle footage showed them and they just decided to go and drive somewhere else and go and pursue Pokemons on their Pokemon Go and catch some Pokemons. I didn't get the names for them. One of them was quite rare. So as an output of that, they had to go to court and all that sort of stuff. Obviously, was stood down and they were eventually fired for playing Pokemon Go.
Some like 2016 type stuff.
Yeah. Apparently, some ridiculous report came out of how much Pokemon Go cost the U.S. economy in its first few weeks. Something like $12 billion or something stupid. Because people were just not fucking going to work and stuff. They were just like out in the fucking park chasing Pokemon. Instead of doing what they meant to do and like people crashing and doing it's just bizarre. Some adults shouldn't have toys. That's all I'm saying. Here in Queensland, this last week, it was revealed that around 20,000 items have been left on Queensland trains or at train stations, like lost property type stuff. 20,000 items. Now, a lot of these items are what you would expect, right? Umbrellas, mobile phones, wireless headphones, stuff like that. Some stuff that was left behind, not quite so much. So, one thing that was left behind at a train station was a stovetop.
What?
Yeah, a stovetop was just accidentally left behind at the train station. Someone's been rushing for their train, picked up their bags, and didn't notice that monumental heavy stovetop that they've probably carried around with them. I dare say someone doesn't have a car and they're about to go to Bunnings to buy a stovetop and they've taken it on the train and forgot about it.
I don't know.
I don't even know why you wouldn't go to lost property and go, have you seen my stovetop? Because I had it and then I can't remember where I've lost it. Like it's not like your lunch money. It's like, it's a fucking stovetop. On top of that, someone lost their false teeth.
Poor Nana.
Poor Nana has no idea where the hell her false teeth went. Somehow mysteriously popped out of her head and landed in a train. Anyway. The person who found it probably would have been just as confused. On top of that, there was some a hearing aid, which they legitimately found the person who had lost it. It was a poor old soul who was already hard of hearing and had turned the hearing aid down because it's quite noisy on trains, and it had fallen out.
And he just didn't notice.
Uh-huh. So they managed to find that one. That's a good news story.
Yeah.
The prosthetic leg, different story.
How do you forget that?
I don't know. Someone lost a prosthetic leg.
We got your whole leg.
I'm guessing they probably went to the prosthetic leg shop and like got a new one. And this might have been their old one, or it might have been the new one that they just haven't fitted yet or something. Maybe it's like spare parts. I don't know. But someone lost a prosthetic leg and hasn't claimed it. Like, hasn't... They probably just gone home and gone, ah, fuck, it was my old one anyway. The knee was wobbly. I don't want it anymore.
Maybe.
If you have lost something on a Queensland train, you can actually go to recover it. They do hold on to things for about 12 months. Maybe a bit longer if it's a thing like a prosthetic leg. So there is a lost property section. If it's not claimed after 12 months, it goes to charity.
Oh, that's good.
Who's going to want to pick up the prosthetic leg or the false teeth? But anyway, it would probably be like false teeth would go on a shelf and then Nana putting it out there is probably when it lost it. She goes, that's my teeth. anyway, so those are the odd bits of general news.
Wait, so if the stuff goes to charity, what if somebody has like loses their mobile phone and it goes to charity? Some poor kid just gets some locked phone that he can't do anything with.
Yeah, I think maybe with the phones, they maybe take them to a tech store and get them, like, wiped. Because you probably wouldn't be able to unlock it, but maybe they're able to wipe it, like, factory reset it without unlocking it.
Yeah.
Not sure with the mobile phones. I know with, like, push bikes and all that type of stuff, which do get left on trains and train stations, weirdly. They do. And hats and stuff. Like, I can imagine a hat. I've lost a fucking hat at a bloody on a bus before, so it does happen. Anyway, that's that interesting news. In other news, and onto some car news, car manufacturers have already started raising the prices of their new cars.
Oh.
So the 2022 C-Class Mercedes, so one of my favorite classes of Mercedes, the C-Class, is going to go up by about $15,000 this year.
Jesus.
That's just on base model, 15 grand. Audi is going to go up by an average of $3,000. And that's with none of these cars have any increase in features or, you know, fitment or, you know, there's no new fucking weird thing that's been fitted to them. No changes whatsoever. And with some of them, the changes are going backwards. So the new Model 3 Teslas, when they first started coming out, they had an additional chip in it that made it suitable, additional components and stuff like that inside the steering that made it suitable for the next level of self-driving. So fully, it was capable of full autonomous driving.
Yeah.
Tesla decided, without telling anybody, that they weren't going to fit that to some of the cars. So from some period to now, if you're out there and you drive a Model 3, it's highly likely your Model 3 doesn't have the bit you think it does.
Oh.
So it can be semi-autonomous, right? It can do, like, what you would expect it to already do now, right? You hit a little button, it'll keep itself in the lane, all that type of stuff. This next lot of hardware and chipsets and stuff is to make it fully autonomous. It'll do everything by itself. The problem is they didn't tell anyone that cutoff when it went from having it to not having it. And they're not going to tell anyone. So they've said it's not in there, and when the parts are available, it'll be retrofitted by a mechanic. But they won't actually tell you if your car hasn't got it. So,
just gotta try it out for yourself.
Yeah, and still sell it for the same price.
Oh, jeez.
You know, your Audis are the same. The price rise has meant there's really no difference, and some stuff has even been taken away. So lumbar support in the passenger seat, if you're expecting to get a back massage and some good lumbar support in the passenger seat, isn't in the Audi now when it was previously. Yeah. So if you're buying one just for lumbar support, bad mark for Audi on that one. And a few other things have been taken out, just other shitty, meaningless things have been taken out of the cars that aren't entirely necessary but just good to have, because of the chip shortage, or because they don't have the componentry, so they're just saying, we'll just take that shit out.
Well, at least it'll be weight reduction.
Yeah, a little. But raise the price. So some of the high-end, the real high-end Audis, like your big, monstrous, whatever they are, Q7 things, they've gone up by like nearly $8,000.
Jeez.
Your little A-series Mercs, your little hatchbacks, only going up by about $1,000. But on average, it's about $3,000. In other car news, Lexus have revealed that from 2025, their IS models are going to be all electric.
That's sad.
They're going to be they reckon they're taking on Tesla Model 3. If they make it fully autonomous, they'll beat them anyway because Teslas don't have that now, apparently. But yeah, they're taking the IS concept, I think, that came out early or late last year. There was a concept IS that came out, real futuristic looking thing.
Yeah.
That's going to be the basis for the new IS electric.
Oh.
And it'll be the first electric, like solar electric type thing that Lexus are going to have. So that's coming out in 2025.
Why can't they, when they make it, what? With car companies, why can't, when they make an electric car, give it a new name, make it something new, not just continue this car you've had for ages and then all of a sudden it's electric.
Yeah, I think it's stupid. I think if you're going to make an electric, you know, even if you go, you know, phase out the IS over the next 3 years.
Yeah.
And then we're going to introduce this all-electric car that is sort of like an IS, but it isn't. It's the electric. Like,
yeah.
Don't try and just go, you know, all the way up to freaking like December 2024 is petrol, and then all of a sudden, bang, oh, here's your electric, which is not how it's going to be, but it's probably what it's like. It's just all of a sudden it's the car that people have liked is now an electric.
Yeah.
And I don't think there's going to be an option for a petrol. It's just going to be electric.
There's, with the, I think it's new Renault Megane, Megane's. I don't know if they've gone full electric, but they have an electric version now. Definitely.
Yeah. So, yeah, so that's really the end of the car news that I had. There's plenty of other weird things happening about the place, but they're not really worth sharing at this point in time. Hyundai's doing something or other, but I couldn't be bothered actually reading it. So we'll move on. We'll move on past that to the old lady update. Is there any other update on the old lady?
Oh, yeah.
You seen her last week or something, didn't you? She's getting into the bus or something now, the bus? No? Was it the week before?
I think that might have been the week before.
But,
yeah, I have seen her on my way to school.
Yep.
So has Ethan.
Yep.
She's just kind of sitting out there with a mask on.
Yeah. No. Being safe from the Rona, I guess. It's the best way to do it. Well, at least she's still alive. It's a freaking miracle to still be alive in this world. All right. Well, with that excitement done with, we'll move on to the tips for young bucks. Today I want to talk about understanding what makes people tick. I like that. It went tick, tick. The point of this is that everyone thinks differently, and the sooner and quicker you can start to realize what motivates people, what makes them tick, what's important to them, will help you decide and guide you through establishing lasting relationships with people. So whether that's your mates or your friends, whether that's someone you fall in love with or whatever that might be, understanding what makes a person tick is going to understand what their motivations are and how that fits into what you want to do. It's one thing that a lot of young people don't do. And when you're young, inevitably, you sort of be a little bit self-centered because you're naturally inclined to do so. All young people are a little bit self-centered. And that's natural, right? That's because you're building your own identity as you're going along and you're establishing yourself. So you're going to be a little bit self-focused. What you miss is not understanding how other people tick. And then over time, relationships are really good start to fall away. And you're not quite sure why. And then new relationships come along and you don't even know why they came along. So there's some good things you can do to help understand and find out what makes people tick. The first part is just actually understanding who they are as a person. Sounds really suck eggs, I know, but a lot of young people don't do it. This is what I'm saying. The benefit of all this is it helps to draw balance, right? Because so you're going to have relationships as you go through life that are give and take. Right, it's not going to all be about you, and it shouldn't all be about them. Sometimes it will, and you got to be able to recognize that to know when the value is not there. They will probably change over time, but at that point in time, that's who they are. And you're very rarely going to change someone who is, you know, if they're an incredibly self-centered person, you're really rarely going to change that. Just not going to. So understanding what makes them tick, understanding what their motivations are, by understanding what their passions are and what they're most interested in, even if it is themselves, will help you to guide you through whether it's a worthwhile relationship or a worthwhile friendship or anything like that that's worthwhile going into. It's really, really important to start to do it early, because it can frame and guide your future self. If you look at all professional people and people who are very, very high achieving and high performing, they will all tell you, you are what you surround yourself with.
Yeah.
So it is important from quite early to surround yourself with people who are going to bring benefit into your life. Because in those early years, you can go down several paths really, really quickly if you're surrounded by the wrong people. So always take the time to try and understand what makes a person tick. What motivates them? What are their interests? What do they care about? And guide your relationships with people that way. It will help in the long run. Onto my stoic quote. This is a quote from Seneca. It says, to always be fortunate and to pass through life with a soul that has never known sorrow is the... To always be fortunate and to pass through life without a soul that has never known sorrow is to be ignorant of one half of nature. That's freaking hard to read. he made that so complex. And the place where I found it, they're like, oh, he says it so clearly. I'm like, no, he doesn't. What it says, and I'll leave both attempts in the final version so you can figure out how fucking hard it is to read. What it basically means is that if you have always been fortunate, like if you've never had to struggle for one second of your life, if you've always had money to do exactly what you wanted, you always got everything you wanted, you never had to go without, you never had to miss something, which some young people have, right? You freaking see them driving around their P-plates in like a freaking E-class Mercedes, right? They've never had to freaking struggle. They have been fortunate their entire life. And if you go through your life being fortunate the entire time, you're missing out on stuff. And what you're missing out on is those lessons of missing out on shit and how to value things, because you know how hard it is to come by. Like if you are incredibly fortunate and you don't have to ever pay for a car ever, or you don't ever have to finance a car ever, where you don't have to try and save every single cent of your money for a car ever. You can just go and freaking daddy can go and buy a new one because you crashed the old one into a fence. You aren't going to learn anything about the value of that.
Yeah.
And therefore, you're not going to care for it. And it is the same with sorrow. If you've never known sorrow and sadness, then you don't know happiness.
Yeah.
It's pretty simple, right? I've had some times where I've had a lot of sorrow. I've lost a lot of mates to suicide. I lost my grandfather when I was, you know, a lot younger, and he was my idol to a degree. They are extremely sorrowful moments and very, very sad. But they teach you lessons, and they teach you about, you know, the importance of life and the importance of having time with people when you can, the importance of maintaining those connections when you can, because there will be a time when you can't. And that time when you can't won't be up to you. It'll be up to all other forces of nature. So people who have never known sorrow, so, you know, have separated and isolated themselves from the world so much that if anything sad comes up, they just ignore it. They're missing out on the value, and that is being ignorant to one half of nature, and that is that things die. Things are hard to come by. Things have to struggle all the time. You go and look at any freaking animal on earth that has to go and find its own food. It's a freaking struggle day to day. But they know how to make that shit work. We as humans have such convenience with most things, we start to forget that from time to time. So this is a pretty good reminder of that. That's what I think anyway.
Yeah.
Largely complex one. Very serious one. I couldn't find a non-serious one. The only non-serious one I could find was my Scooby-Doo one. I don't want to use that yet.
When are you going to use that one?
I don't know. A special occasion one, that one. I'm holding off on the Scooby-Doo one.
Episode 100.
Yeah, probably. on to Australia's prime ministers. So we are up to Prime Minister number 12 today, a man called Stanley Bruce. Now, most people won't know who Stanley Bruce is. If you live in Canberra and you live in a suburb of Bruce, it's named after this man. If you're in Greater Melbourne and you're in the electorate of Bruce, named after this man. So there you go. That's what he's famous for. No, he's famous for more things than that. Stanley Bruce was born in Melbourne in 1883 to quite a wealthy family at the time. Went to private schools, you know, all that type of stuff, right? Lived quite wealthy. Lots of family businesses and financial interests and all that type of stuff. The Great Depression of the 1880s, so in the 1880s to the 1890s, there was a Great Depression. Banks went fucking bust, you know, businesses closed, it was no work, all that type of stuff. It hit their family really hard. They lost most of their family fortune in that Great Depression. In 1899, yeah, I got that right, 1899, Stanley's brother took his own life in 1899. Oh. In 1901, his father took his own life. His brother, through mental health issues, his father, through the pressures of all the family businesses and the impacts of the Great Depression and all that type of stuff. So after that, they moved to the UK, moved across to the UK, and he attended Cambridge. And they actually borrowed money from somewhere. In fact, in 1901, there wouldn't be much money around. But they borrowed money so he could go to Cambridge in the UK and study. And he became quite a successful lawyer and all types of stuff. And with the help of his other brother, rebuilt, you know, the family fortune to a degree. You know, got a fair bit of money back. Returned back to Australia for a short period of time to take over control of the company. Right at the time of World War One kicked out. Kicked off. So came back to Australia right at the time of World War One. He decided to enlist, go and fight for the Empire because he was very pro-British. So he went and fought for the Empire. But he enlisted in the British Army, not the Australian Army, in the British Army because he was able to. The reason he did that is because it was going to be easier for him to become an officer in the British Army than it would become an officer in the Australian Army.
Yeah.
So that's why he did that. He was made into a lieutenant and was sent to Gallipoli.
Oh.
So he was the British, he was part of, I think, the 29th Battalion, maybe wrong, 29th Battalion.
Wasn't it in Gallipoli the British didn't get it as bad as those?
Yeah, they went to the right beach,
yeah.
I think. But yeah, he landed, I think, on Healy's Beach. I think it's the beach he landed on. And yeah, so he went to Gallipoli. He was awarded the Military Cross and the Cross de Guerre, I think that's how you say it, Croix de Guerre, in the first 3 months of being over there. So Military Cross is the cross for gallantry that's afforded to officers, or warrant officers and officers. And the Croix de Guerre is the French cross for gallantry. So he, you know, natural born leader. You know, he attended Cambridge, very educated man, went over there, led the offences to get into the trenches, led all that type of stuff, led his men. On the 3rd of June, he got shot in the arm.
Oh.
He recovered, but he missed the assault. So on the 4th of June, there was a massive assault by the British on the 4th of June. And if anyone who knows history knows that offensive, copped a lot of injuries, like a massive amount of injuries, lost a lot of people.
Yeah.
And his unit was one of the units right at the front of that.
Oh, it would have died.
Yeah,
probably.
Potentially, yeah. So he missed that. He went back to his unit after recovering from being shot in the arm and was promoted to captain on August 15th. On the 26th of September, he was shot in the knee.
Oh.
And that got him taken out of Gallipoli on the 26th of September. And they returned him to England to recuperate. So whilst in England, his brother stepped down from managing the companies and wanted to enlist into the army and come over and fight in the war. So Stanley himself tried to resign, and the War Office went, nope, you're not resigning. We don't accept your resignation, which they can do in war times, mainly because he was a really good public speaker. And he was very much pro the military effort and that type of stuff. So they thought they were able to leverage his ability to speak in front of people. And, you know, he's got a military cross and he's got all these things. He's highly decorated. He's like fucking the Australian version of Uncle Sam, right? Fucking walk around and pointing at people and shit. So he, as part of that, he returned to Australia to assist in the war efforts and assist in getting people into the war. So he'd go and speak and present different in front of people and all that type of nonsense. During that time, Billy Hughes, of course, was the Prime Minister during World War One, recognised his potential and his ability to speak and recognised his political potential. So convinced the War Office to accept his resignation, Stanley's resignation, so he could get into politics, which they did on June 1917. He was no longer part of the military forces. And after that, he did a bunch of stuff and a whole stack load of variety of different things. To the main point, though, he became Prime Minister in 1923. So if we remember back to last week, Billy Hughes needed to do a coalition and they didn't want him as Prime Minister because they didn't like him.
Yeah.
Stanley was the man who came in.
Oh.
So Stanley was the man who came in to Prime Minister straight after that and stepped in. He became the first Prime Minister to not be part of the original Federation. So when the Federation originally came together, all those people that were part of bringing the Federation together and doing all the constitution and shit, he wasn't part of that. He wasn't in politics when that happened. Every other Prime Minister before that had been.
Yeah.
Just the first one to not be part of the Federation. And he's also the first one to have never been in state parliament. So he'd never been in like Victorian Parliament or New South Wales Parliament as a member or a minister or the premier or none of that. He'd only ever come into federal politics pretty recently, like 1923.
Yeah.
like recently in. So when he got in, he immediately recognized that Australia needed to, you know, amp up its agriculture and its industrialism and stuff like that, and wanted to build up the whole agriculture and farming sector of the nation, even though all the scientists at the time said the weather's crap and the soil is crap, don't go and farm on it. Like, this is out in rural, way back rural of fucking New South Wales and shit like that, right? Places where they farm now and have farmed for generations, at the very beginning of that, all the scientists were going, no, don't do that. Anyway, he did, and they set aside £34 million to immigrate British people to Australia to work the land. Only British, couldn't come from many other countries in the Commonwealth. No, only British. They thought the other countries were not suitable to come and farm in Australia. Why the freaking hell you would think someone from Britain, right, where the top gets to like fucking 30 degrees for one day every century, can come to Australia and go into outback New South Wales where it's 30 degrees for 6 months of the year and 40s or 50s sometimes. You're just going to get pommed to wander over and go, there you go, buddy, there's your land. You fucking cry for 6 weeks. Anyway, they put aside $34 million. The aim was to have about 500,000 immigrants come over to start working these farms. And part of the grant scheme was they basically bring them over and give them all the shit and go, fucking, here you go. Go and start putting something in the ground, right? Just go and do stuff. They expected 500,000. They got 200,000.
Jeez.
But they still got 200,000. Quite a fair few roadblocks to all of that. Most of the people were like, I'm fucking, as soon as they seen it, it's like, I'm not fucking working that. Anyway, on they went. He continued his borrowing spree. He borrowed £370 million from the UK.
Jeez.
In the early years for economic development. So at that point in time, Australia had, it didn't have a deficit. Like, it had a pretty good surplus. It had a pretty good stash of cash, but not big, not vast amount of cash, right? It's only a relatively new nation. It had been through a war, so there was a bit of industrialization that had come from that sort of helped. But they were still, you know, they still needed big amounts of money if they wanted to really push on with a lot of the stuff they wanted to do. So he borrowed heaps of money. He established the Main Roads Development Act. Now, this basically meant that they would give money to the states, as they do now, for certain roads to build them and maintain them and keep them, but they're the roads that the federal government and in their own policies and their own transportation plans care about. You know, the Hume Highway, the Pacific Highway, you know, here in Queensland to agree, the Bruce Highway, the big major roads that connect things, that's where that act came from.
Yeah.
So they can basically guide infrastructure to a certain degree because they would give the money, the vast majority of the money, to go and build the thing. And then just say the states, we'll give you money, you go and build it and look after it. So it laid the way for that. And what it laid the way for was to take the control solely away from the states into what roads got built where. And the federal agenda could start to push where the roads got put.
Yeah.
And how big they were, all that type of stuff. They also did, he also pushed for modernization of the government. So he did quite a fair few things to modernize the government. Some of them really simple, and some of the stuff that we do now in business and in government now, right? So formal agendas for things. So if you're going to have a meeting, there's a formal agenda. Before that, there was no freaking formal agenda. It's just a bunch of blokes sitting around the room and go, what are we talking about today? So like what we do with the podcast. Yeah. So formal agendas, there was pre-meeting notes and members had to circulate what they were going to talk about to everyone in advance so they could look at it, think about it, and put their points together around the discussions and stuff. Stuff that we do now. He established the CSIRO. Now, if you don't know, the CSIRO is a mob, who I can never remember their name, but it's Research and something or something, an organization. They basically look after agriculture and farming development and all that type of stuff. He established that back in the 20s. Because they needed it to try and boost agriculture and get agriculture working. They needed to figure out how the fucking hell to make it all work. That's what they were brought on to do. It also moved, he was part of the move to Parliament House in Canberra. So that was, Parliament House was being built during the World War One period, slower than anticipated, obviously, because, you know, shit happening. But they moved, he was part of the, his government was the government that moved into the old Parliament House, what was the new Parliament House then, to take up office.
So where was that?
So the old Parliament House is effectively in front of the new Parliament House.
Oh.
So it's sort of on the same side. You know, you've got like the lake, Lake Burley Griffin, and you've got like Parliament House sits up on the hill. The old one sits a bit further back down the hill. And it just looks like a big old white building.
I think of when I went to Canberra in grade 6.
Mm.
I think I saw it.
Yeah. And mainly it does like art gallery and stuff and things like that. Now, it's nowhere near as big as the new one.
Yeah.
The new one is freaking monstrous and, you know, half underground for some reason. But the old ones are more of a conventional, what you would expect from like a early century sort of building.
Yeah, I'm pretty sure I've been in both of them, maybe, when I went there.
Yeah, generally when you go on school excursions, you go to Old Parliament House and it's more of an art gallery and sort of historical place.
Yeah.
And then you go to New Parliament House and it's actually got all the thingies, you know, House representatives in the Senate and all that type of stuff and the coloured rooms and things.
Green and the maroon or whatever.
Yeah, whatever it is. Whatever shitty colours they chose. So he also pushed for greater involvement and alignment with the British Empire. So he was very pro the Empire. He was very pro everyone within the Empire working together, having common policies and strategies and how we structure our militaries and all that sort of stuff to be dead aligned. A lot of resistance came from that, including from other nations who were like, no, we'll do our own thing, thanks. Because they didn't want to align to the Empire. It was freaking half a world away and a freaking tiny island. Like, it was nothing in comparison to most of the rest of the colonies that it occupied.
Yeah.
You know, even freaking New Zealand's probably bigger than Britain. I don't know, I've not measured it, but it probably is.
Probably.
So, you know, they pushed back, but he continued to push. He continued to push that common agenda. He also pushed through quite a fair few legislations that were quite controversial. So in the mid-20s there was a lot of industrial action, like a lot of it. There was strikes from and don't laugh, but from the Seamen Union. So the Seamen Union were a bunch of seamen who had a union. So it's basically like your waterfront workers and stuff like that, your boat operators and things like that, you know.
It's not a very good choice of name. We're the seamen.
Yeah, and some probably make a mess everywhere they go. Anyway, they had a whole stack load of strikes, and for different reasons, right? They were trying to get better pays. They were trying to get, you know, less injuries. They were trying to get a whole stack load of stuff because, you know, waterfront work was pretty risky. To combat that, he brought in a couple of acts. Number one was the Navigation Act, which allowed British boats to come in and work within Australian harbours and waters, even if they weren't part of Australia's trade union fucking acts and rules and stuff like that.
This guy really likes Britain.
Yeah, yeah. And he also did some stuff with the Immigration Act, which gave the Commonwealth power to deport any foreign worker who was, and I'll quote it, who was guilty of disrupting the industrial life of the community.
What does that mean?
So that means if they go on strike for too long, and they cause people to lose wages, or they cause businesses to shut down, and a special tribunal finds them guilty of that, the Commonwealth can just get them and go, you're out.
No.
Just deport them back to wherever they came from.
Oh.
Even if they don't, they're legally allowed in Australia, still, jump, out you go. Which didn't go down well.
Yeah.
As you can imagine. And the industrial action continued for years. So they were re-elected in 1925 and 1928, despite all the way through all of those years, there being ongoing industrial action and strikes from, like, the waterfront guys, from the British boat operators themselves had a strike because they were striking because someone else was striking. Like, it was full on. He kept coming out, like the government kept coming out with like a whole stack load of various acts to try and control all of the situations, and they continued to strike. So they came up with one piece of legislation that basically said that in determining whether a trade agreement, like a pay agreement, was adequate, the trade council or the trade court, whatever the hell it was, industrial relations court, not only had to take into account economical benefits to the worker and safety benefits that were going to come from this new agreement, they also had to take into consideration the community and financial impact of the community and the government. So they basically said, yeah, it's all right. Consider whether he's going to get enough money to feed his kids, and consider whether he's actually not going to get fucking killed. But make sure he doesn't fucking make sure he doesn't lose us any money. Is basically what it was. It was more about not losing money on trade. So that caused a huge amount of contention, because what effectively happened was the focus became trade related, and people were losing income because these new agreements were getting them paid less, not more, but yeah, less money. So yeah, there was strikes and stuff just continue to happen. It was just constant turmoil and strikes, which led eventually to a lot of tension between the private sectors and unions and both parties of government, both major parties of government, the result of which they held an early election in 1929. So that 1 year after already having an election, they went back to the polls, and Stanley lost. But not only did he lose, he also lost his own seat, which is the first time that had happened. And it won't happen. After he lost his seat in 1929, the next prime minister to lose their seat at an election won't happen again until 2007.
Jeez.
Like, it is rare for the prime minister, that interim prime minister, to lose, and he lost to an independent.
Oh.
Yeah, he lost his own seat, which they didn't think was going to happen. There was no indication that his seat was at risk or anything like that, and yet he lost it. So effectively didn't continue in federal politics at that point in time, because he didn't even have a seat to go and sit in.
Yeah.
So he wasn't part of the opposition or anything like that, like a lot of the other prime ministers were. He didn't sort of fade out through, you know, political retirement. He basically, they just one day they're like, nah, you're out. That's the end of you. He came back, he managed to be reelected in 1931. And he stayed in office till 1933. And then in 1933, he went and became the High Commissioner to the UK, which is quite a common thing for, you know, some seasoned ministers and elected officials to go and become that, and that would have suited him anyway. And eventually he passed away in 1967.
Uh-huh.
So, you know, he did quite a fair few different things throughout his later life with different sort of parties and organisations and stuff like that. But yeah, he was over in the High Commission until 45. So he was over in the High Commission until into World War II.
Yeah.
So, not only did he fight in World War I, but he was pivotal in that early political peace in 1944. So, you know, he was pretty well involved in all of it over his years.
Yeah.
But despite all of that, most people don't even know Stanley Bruce at all.
So he went from being in a really rich family, losing it all to a Great Depression, then losing his father and his brother to suicide.
Yep.
To then serving in World War One.
Yep.
For a while.
Yep.
And then just becomes Prime Minister.
Then becomes Prime Minister, yeah.
And then gets booted off.
Yep.
And then does other stuff for a while.
Yep. Yeah. Jeez. And I mean, and the sad and the tragedy in all of that is his other brother. So the other brother that he took over from in the family business, and his brother who went and fought in the war, he went and fought in the war, and not long after coming home took his own life as well.
Oh.
Jeez. So, you know, there was a lot of tragedy in his life. He wasn't able to have children.
Oh.
And, you know, having lost most of the loved ones he knows and then not even have children, he had a pretty tough life, you know, all in all.
So that was the end of his bloodline?
Yeah, oh, pretty well, I think. Yeah, yeah. Because I don't think anyone else, I think it was just his sister that was left.
Yeah.
So, yeah, so, you know, that's a pretty heavy thing to carry, as well as everything he did. But he he remained strong all the way through all that political stuff.
Yeah.
And all that industrial stuff, even though people didn't like what he did. You know, a lot of those early decisions around, you know, the action against unions and stuff like that became pivotal later on when, you know, unions have a lot more control. So, you know, he tried to make that stand early against them.
Yeah.
And keep things under control and really struggled because the nation was struggling at that point in time as well anyway. You know, after a war, a lot of nations do struggle.
Yeah.
Australia didn't lose a lot of infrastructure as part of the war, not like other nations did, you know, not like Germany or France or Japan or stuff like that. You know, they had struggles, but they had stuff to get on with, you know, rebuilding cities and rebuilding infrastructure. Australia really didn't have that. People just came home from war and, it, you know, it was just nothing.
Yeah.
So he needed to get stuff moving. He needed to get industrialization moving and getting people working and stuff like that. And that became a real struggle,
yeah,
in those early years. So that is the life of one Stanley Bruce.
I've got a bit of a thing on Billy Hughes.
Yeah,
he was Prime Minister during World War One.
Yep.
When at the so I learned all this in history class.
Yeah,
because we're doing like World War One and stuff.
Mm-hmm.
Is at the Treaty of Versailles, which is spelled like Versailles or whatever. It's
yep.
French.
Yep.
Japan wanted to do this like racial equality thing. And this is the reason why Japan sided with Germany in World War II.
Yep.
It was rejected. And yep. One of the people who rejected this racial equality thing was Billy Hughes.
Yeah.
Because he didn't like the, I guess he just didn't like the Japanese.
Yeah. Yeah.
I mean, there was a lot of racism at that time and Billy Hughes was a little bit racist.
Yeah. Yeah. And which is interesting because, you know, Billy Hughes spoke out about, you know, the poor treatment of indigenous people in Australia. One of the first ones to do that. So
you might have just not liked Asian people.
Everyone has their own views. Oh. there's always been, you know, in those early years, there was always a lot of, you know, views around, you know, the Asian cultures coming into countries and stuff like that and the influence and impact of that.
Yeah.
And at that point in time, yeah, most definitely there was probably quite a lot of racism and separation and hate because the world was largely separated then. Like,
yeah.
You know, countries like Japan and China, entirely foreign, like no visibility in them, just these unknown places. They didn't sort of have the industrial might they do now and the manufacturing might where fucking 3/4 of everything comes from China.
Yeah.
You know, stuff that came from China was quite rare. They sort of didn't have what they have now. So people sort of looked at them weirdly when they seen them. It's like, crap, there's a Chinese person. Where's your rice hat? you know, like it's just what people thought, because that's all they knew.
Yeah.
And people were, you know, they were quite racist. Yeah, you can't get around that truth. And that would have been evident then. You know, and it's interesting, you know, you can imagine how bad it must have been for Japan then in World War II to go, you know, we're going to side with Germany, thanks. Like, you can imagine how insulted they must have felt by all of that if that's, you know, that's where they went.
Yeah.
From there.
And then they went really, like, I think, was it nationalist? Like, yeah. Really, like, yeah. ran themselves.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Made an empire.
And, you know, in later on, we can cover off on some of that, you know, the lead-in from Japan. But, you know, America are not innocent in Japan's move to war.
Yeah.
They really pushed them to, you know, industrialize and to update what they did and you know, get building stuff and all that type of thing, which didn't fucking help neither. I think there's some parts which I have to research, but I'm pretty sure there's some parts where America fucking stiffed Japan on quite a lot of stuff, which fucking made it worse.
Yeah.
But yeah, it's interesting when you learn about bits and pieces like that. You know, actions like that can have huge consequences.
Yeah.
That happen and repeat themselves throughout history.
Because if that wasn't rejected and if Japan didn't side with Germany in World War II, then Pearl Harbor wouldn't have been bombed, which means America wouldn't have intervened. That's the only reason America came in.
Yeah, yeah. Look, it could have turned out entirely different. Yeah. You know, and it might not have been the same level of conflict. It might not have been no conflict at all. They could have just remained impartial and out of it entirely, which probably would have massively changed the outcome of World War II had US not actually entered the European theater.
Yeah.
And left the European theater to the Allies. They were already struggling. You know, you don't have the US there to help. You wouldn't be able to tell the difference that would make.
Yeah.
You know, the change of power and the you know, the change of control after D-Day and stuff like that, you can't compensate for what would happen if that wasn't there.
Yeah.
Probably a lot of historians could give it a whack, but not me. I can't compensate for what would happen. So it's just a good sign of, you know, being mindful of, you know, a decision and an action, because none of them would have even thought any more about that.
Yeah.
Afterwards, they would have treated Japan like this tiny little silly country in the middle of fucking nowhere. It's just a bunch of islands, don't know nothing.
Yeah.
And that's probably how they continue to treat them until they attack Pearl Harbor, because no one fucking expected any single fucking part of that.
Yeah.
Everyone was blind by that. So that showed how much everyone disregarded them.
Yeah.
And, you know, that's and they don't do that in the modern world. Everyone's looked at. Everyone looks at everyone now.
Yeah.
Because everyone's a freaking risk. France is a freaking risk. Yeah. So, you know, the French people are more dangerous than everyone else. They make breadsticks.
A couple more things about World War One and the Treaty of Versailles.
Yeah.
Is Italy also in World War II sided with Germany because they felt that they weren't treated well enough at the end of World War One.
Yeah.
You know, they had a huge part in it, they fought in it, and they got kind of shit all from it. It's like, oh, yeah. Congratulations, pat on the back, fucking good on you. And then they're like, oh, we're just gonna go to Germany next time.
Yeah.
And when the Germans came to the Treaty of Versailles, and actually with the Treaty of Versailles, they were there for like 6 months or something.
Yeah.
It's just all the world's leaders in this one place for 6 months. I'm surprised no one came and did some terrorist attack.
Like, yeah, yeah. You can imagine the freaking security it would be needed now. If you put all the world's leaders into a place for 6 months, freaking hell.
If that happened now, some fucking dude's going to come out and no one just blow the place up. Like.
Yeah, yeah. The only place you'd be able to do it is on the moon.
But yeah, so when the Germans went there, they first sent the German Prime Minister, and he was like trembling and everything. He walked into the room, and he's walking into a room full of people that fucking want to kill him.
Yeah.
And he gives a speech, and at the end, apparently, it made them hate the Germans even more because the speech was so shit. It was so bad, they hated them even more. And he basically refused to do any of this stuff that they wanted Germany to do. And they're like, if you don't do it, it's going to invade your country and fucking tear it down.
Yeah, yeah.
So they sent two other people and they went there and they signed the peace treaty and everything.
Yep.
And they were all like white in the face and stuff because, again, in a room full of people who want to kill you.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah. So it's almost like just walking into your own death sentence and just hoping they actually forget that they're meant to kill you.
Yeah.
I reckon they would have fucking left there and went and got fucking blind drunk after leaving, get back into Germany and just fucking go into hiding.
But yeah, I kind of feel like, okay, in World War II, yeah, Germany's bad.
Mm.
But in World War I, I feel like Germany shouldn't have sort of taken the whole blame, because, I mean, I don't know what country killed the... What was that guy from? Was it like Austria, Franz Ferdinand?
Yeah, yeah, the Duke. Yeah.
Yeah, I don't know who killed him, but it was just some random guy.
Mm.
And then because of all the treaties and stuff, Germany kind of had to be like, you can't do that. We're going to have to stop you from killing off our friends' people.
Yeah.
And then all the other countries like, oh my God, Germany's fucking all got to get on that.
Mm. Mm.
And then it spiraled out of control. Yeah. And then they're like, oh, just went to Germany. They did it all. They started.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. It just descended into war.
Yeah.
Yeah. And that's, like, that can be the bad thing about war. Like, in World War II, everyone knows damn well who fucking started it. Like,
yeah.
World War II is pretty fucking clear. Even, you know, Japan, you could probably argue they were almost pushed. But anyway, we know kicked off fucking Japan's involvement in the war.
Yeah.
And the same with America. Like, it's pretty clear where it kicked off. World War One, a little bit more sort of all over the place. There's no real anyone going... There's no one going, oh, we're absolutely forced into it. We had no... fucking choice. It's like
there was already sort of tension, I think, before World War One. Like in apparently 1871, Germany ex Prussia took France and did some stuff there, and the French people didn't like that. So when the Treaty of Versailles happened, the French prime minister, I think they have, or whoever their guy is, like wanted Germany to be like just absolutely shit on, like like absolutely, because you know how they only had like 100,000 soldiers in the military. He went like no soldiers, like no money, no infrastructure, just nothing. Basically he wanted to tear everything down and invade the place without actually having to do that. America wanted like, oh, you know, we'll give you a bit of a punishment, but don't do this next time. And the American Prime Minister wanted a League of Nations, which is basically the old version of the United Nations. Which, I don't know, I guess went to shit or something. I don't know what happened to that. And then England just wanted, like, oh, just get over and done with. Just do something to Germany. We just go back to fucking making tea or something.
And I think it, from memory, Billy Hughes was one of the... He was the first Australian delegate to go to something like that anyway. So it was the first time Australia had actually been involved in something like that.
Yeah.
So it hadn't actually been involved in something like that before. So I'm pretty surprised he actually said anything.
And then after World War One, Australia got, I think it was Papua New Guinea and another small continent that I always forget the name of.
Oh, okay.
I forgot what it was called, but it's just some fucking small continent Germany used to have for some reason.
No. Oh, okay.
I think probably next to Papua New Guinea somewhere.
Oh.
So, yeah.
Right, yeah. Yeah. Well,
Australia got that.
Yeah, well, there's a few. Australia has a few. Oh, geez, what do they call them? So we've got territories, states, and we have another group of areas that are called something else, and it's gone from my head. So I will find that out for next time. Someone's probably on the podcast going, it's fucking this idiot. Thank you. Please share it for next time. So, yeah, you know, Jervis Bay is one of those. It's not, it's managed by New South Wales, but it's its own area. Great Keppel Islands, the same thing. Cook Islands are the same thing.
Yeah.
Tasmania's a state, unfortunately. I don't know why, but it is. So, in Northern Territory, obviously, is a territory. It's not a state. But anyway, we'll get into how our country's laid out later on, because that would confuse the rest of the world, the fact that we just don't have states.
Yeah.
Like everyone else does. All right, cool.
Yeah.
Well, I don't really have anything else. That is me for this episode.
I could keep talking about World War One. I reckon World War One's a lot more interesting because it's got more to it, and there's more stuff that happened previously.
Yeah.
And it's this weird combination between modern type of warfare. You know, you're not wearing bright clothes anymore like they were.
Yeah.
1700s, and it's like, you know, a lot more muddy, a lot more serious. Yeah. And then it looked like 30 years back, 1870, you look at like Germany and Prussia, they got this like bright blue uniform.
Yeah.
They got the, oh, what's it called? I knew the name of their helmets. Pickle helmet. Pickle.
A pickle.
It was like pickle hobber. It was a pickle hobber. That's the name of the helmet. The one with the spiky tip.
Yeah.
And it's all bright and blue, and then they become Germany. Wasn't like before Germany, it was Prussia and other countries? Other like Germanic countries?
Yeah. I think the borders were a little bit different.
Yeah. And then they became together and made Deutschland.
Mm.
And then they were like, you know, World War One came along and they're like, all right, we need maybe not bright blue uniforms, so we'll do like gray with red.
Yeah.
And then in the middle, I think 1915, they went to the helmets.
Yeah.
The storm helmets. I don't know.
Yeah, well, it's probably just a spike off, because if you look over top of the trenches, all you see is these spikes walking around. You sort of know where the people are.
Yeah.
it's like an antenna.
Apparently, because I think you could screw them off.
Yeah.
For that, but then they just went to actual helmets instead, and then they used those again in World War II.
Yeah, they're much better formed.
Yeah.
Helmet, more ballistic shaped.
And became pretty famous because that we use in World War II.
Yeah. It's an interesting topic, and I think once we're past the Prime Minister's thing, some of those other topics we can look at, you know, the important parts throughout history of, you know, either different conflicts or different, you know, events throughout time, throughout our history, because a lot of that does shape, a lot of that early history, especially 1914, does shape, I guess, the Australian narrative and what Australia is.
Yeah.
And how it sees itself is sort of shaped by those early conflicts.
I also prefer World War One because I feel like it had a lot more outcomes. Like, you know, one guy was shot and killed, and then that led to America becoming pretty noticed by the rest of the world. You had, like, three big empires toppled. Germany, the Austrian people, and then Russia, I think. I don't really know what team was Russia on in World War One, because weren't they on the Allies, but then something happened to them? I don't know.
And I don't want to do a disservice by guessing, but I know they were on a side, and then they swapped a side, and then they were back or something, and then they were on a different side.
And
then the Cold
War, and they were like, I hate America.
Yeah, it's just like, but I think it was dependent on who was in charge of Russia at what time, was which way they were facing.
Yeah.
But again, I think it was part of Russia's changes were the way they were being treated and what they were getting out of it. I think they were getting lied to by the Germans for a while.
Yeah.
And that sort of directed which way they were going to go and what they did.
Yeah.
And they were quite a sizey army, poorly equipped and you know.
Until they got the Kalashnikov.
Well, yeah, and Kalashnikov changed everything. It's like the arrival of the AK-47. You know, it just changes everything. And for us Australians here, the arrival of the SLR.
Yeah.
SLR changed everything.
What about the Oster? Did that change anything?
The fact we went to a plastic gun. I still prefer the SLR. I still think the SLR is probably one of the best weapons we could ever had of an Australian soldier.
Is the SLR kind of similar to like a FAL? I feel like
SLR's it's a 7.62.
Yeah,
it's a semi-auto.
They're both similar in how they are, their specs, I guess.
A very basic operator weapon too.
Yeah,
like they're not hugely complex, which made them perfect in certain theaters. And they were, they had a hell of a thump when you fired them, whopping recoil.
Yeah,
but 7.62 millimeter, so phenomenal range.
Yeah.
Upwards touching 1,000 meters of range.
But then you get closer and it's not going to do as good, is it?
Well, it's probably just going to blow things apart. 7.62 at too much of a close range.
This is going to go right through.
Yeah, probably.
That's why.
But they were iron sight. Most of them didn't have scopes or anything like that.
They were pretty rugged.
Yeah. And heavy.
Yeah.
Fuck, they were heavy. That's why the Steyr was better. The Steyr wasn't quite so heavy, but the SLR looked better when you did, you know, weapons drill and stuff. The SLR was a much better looking weapon than a Steyr. Steyr doesn't look like a good, it's not a good ceremonial weapon.
Yeah.
The SLR is better because it's wood finish.
Yeah.
You know, so it can, it's wood and black. Like it can look good as a ceremonial weapon. And I think the Honor Guard still uses them. don't think they use Styes. Well, they might use Styes now, but for a while they used SLRs, ceremonial.
Were the SLRs entirely Australian?
I don't know who actually made them.
Because you know, because we all know that the Ostie is just the org, which is from Austria.
Yeah.
Which is the same. It's kind of weird because Austria is pretty similar to Australia.
Yeah, yeah.
So, I mean, that kind of makes sense.
Well, that's how you make... That's commercialism for you, right? Those guys figured it out when they made that gun. Was like, we'll call it the Ostie, and then we can sell it in Austria and Australia.
Yeah.
You don't need to change nothing. No, we just... It's the Ostie. Go over here and speak Austrian, selling the Ostie. Go to Australia, speak Australian, selling the Ostie. Perfect. Can't lose. And look, it served me well on deployment, so yeah, I'm not going to complain about it, but I still would have preferred an SLR.
What do you think of the new A3? Is it A3 or A4, whatever? The really like tactical ones, you know, all the Picatinny rails and stuff.
Hate them.
They're not as plastic now, I think. I think they might use a slightly stronger plastic.
I think they're more rugged and they look more hardcore in the modern environment. All I can see with those things is they will get caught on fucking everything. Like, as a driver, the one thing you don't want is a weapon that's going to get caught on shit. Because you get your weapon out of the center gun rack in the middle of a vehicle, you don't want it getting caught on the fucking steering wheel and on the seatbelt and fucking on everything else as you're trying to get it out of the vehicle while you're being shot at. You just want to get the goddamn thing out of the vehicle.
Yeah.
And if it's got rails and bits of all sorts of shit hanging off it that aren't a gun, then all they're going to do is get you caught in your seatbelt and you get your ass shot because your gun's stuck. Like, that's all that's going to happen.
Yeah.
You want something that you can just rip out of there and get the fuck out of there quick. And that's why the Styes was good, because it was small enough. It was quick and easy enough to get out. Like, you could just sort of grab it as you're going and it would just come out and not get caught on much stuff. I think it caught it on the steering wheel once. That was my own fault. So, you know, when you get too big and complicated and it's got too much shit hanging off it, that's more shit that just gets caught on things.
Yeah.
So it's probably good in certain environments, and infantry probably love it for what it does, but not everyone's infantry.
Yeah.
So, you know, people use them for different things. I think I used mine for a hammer a few times. Wheel chuck once. Break? No, it's fine. It worked well. I just hit it with the bottom of it.
We've went on a bit of a tangent from, like, Australian Prime Minister to World War One to guns.
And that's what we do. That's how we roll. That's what it's a variety show. We could go anywhere with this show. Anywhere, and we usually do. All right, well, that's about it. I don't think we want to waffle on with anything else.
I'll leave it there.
Have much else to talk about. We got past an hour well and truly. It's probably one of our longer episodes yet again. Even more value if you stayed to the end.
Congratulations.
We
should do some more episodes, maybe, so sort of based around the sort of war stuff, because I think it's kind of interesting.
Yeah, we could do. I also want to do some more, some other things as well as we go along. So, you know, we're moving along. We're now into the 20s with the prime ministers, so we're now getting quite a fair way along with that. You know, it won't take long to get into or close to current prime ministers.
Yeah,
I don't think we'll make ScoMo by the time the election comes along, but you never know. He may hold out long enough for us to actually get to that point where we're past prime ministers and I don't have to research a brand new prime minister I know nothing about. And then, yeah, I want to do a large variety of things. So we can probably do some conflict stuff. We can probably do, you know, other, you know, historical importances and stuff throughout Australia and Australia's history. Some of those real pivotal, important times that we've had throughout our small history, because Australia's history is tiny compared to most other nations.
200 years, maybe.
Yeah.
Other places go on for like thousands.
Yeah, so, you know, our history isn't as big, but there's other parts I want to explore, and one of those parts I do want to explore at some point in time is the Indigenous history, because I think that's important to know along with everything else.
Yeah.
So I want to try and strike that balance between having, you know, our history as modern Australia, as Federation Australia, probably a little bit of history before Federation, because there are some key pivotal parts in our earlier history that sort of guide where we've gone and how the country's been shaped, as well as, you know, cultural history and as well as all other types of bits and pieces throughout our history, because I think it's all got value in it.
Is there any, like, good documented, like, you know, before British came to Australia?
Well,
like any there, big events that
well,
happened?
Not really. I mean, there is a few bits of documented stuff around when the Dutch came to Australia. You know, indigenous wise, and I've not researched it enough. There's probably not a lot of written history, but there's a lot of story history. There's a lot of learnt history.
Yeah.
Which sort of comes from, you know, the way indigenous cultures retain history.
I think a lot of Australians already know quite a few of those indigenous stories because they teach it in school.
Yeah, yeah. I want to try and touch on some of the ones they don't teach in school.
Yeah. So not just the rainbow serpent and
no.
That's about it.
Because that's what I want to try and do with some of this podcast is not just touch on the things they teach as part of a popular curriculum in a high school.
Yeah.
That has some place, but, you know, curriculum is narrative based. So there will be stuff that, you know, they've gone, no, we ain't going to teach them that for whatever reason. And I think it's important for some of that stuff to be known.
Yeah.
So there'll probably be some stuff, you know, I don't want to go down the main paths that are taught, you know, as a majority to school students. I want to try and go down some of those other paths and learn some other parts of history that people might not know.
Yeah.
But may still be just as important. And it's the same with conflicts, right? Everyone learns about fucking Anzac Day in school. They don't learn about what's an Anzac. Like, they don't learn about what made an Anzac.
We learn what it stands for.
You learn what it stands for, but, you know, it's very hard for a school teacher to purvey meaning of an Anzac and what it means and where that lies in part of the fabric of being Australian. Because that Anzac spirit lays in, you know, the very early foundations of being Australian.
Yeah.
So, you know, and it's still alive now. You know, when you join the military services, that Anzac spirit is there. So, you know, it's still there. And I think that's why I want to teach a broad lot of things is because, you know, what you're taught inside education has to fit in quite a narrow window.
Yeah.
It can't go too far down one path. It can't get too graphic. It can't go too far with things. It's just within a window, and that's what you learn.
Yeah.
There's stuff outside the window that's also valuable throughout life. So I want to get into those parts.
Yeah.
Go outside of what's taught in a school and see where the freaking hell that lands me. Hopefully not in trouble. Anyway, we will go with that. So that is really about it. We've waffled along long enough. We're now an hour and a quarter.
Jeez.
About that.
Longest episode.
Yep. So thank you everyone for listening and your patience as we waffled along for the last 15 minutes. And we will see you all next week.
Goodbye. See ya.